This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello, welcome to CarCast plus Edmund's podcast. I'm gonna get used to that at some point. Well, I wanted to say thanks for everyone who's been tuning into the show and sending us some comments. I've been getting messages from you guys and some DMs saying you enjoy it, and Alistair's not a bad chap, which I thought we knew that already, but that's okay. For those of you who are just getting introduced to him. But this is the CarCast plus Edmund's podcast, the version of CarCast that includes our friends from Edmunds.com and Alistair Weaver. How are you?
I'm okay, thank you. That was a glorious introduction.
I realize there's some newbies. There's some new people tuning in, new people getting on to.
I have actually noticed on my Instagram a few people. We at Weaver on Cars, which I know you always enjoy. I've had a few people. Join there. So yeah. It's nice to be involved, and obviously done the show with you and Bill once a month for past God 5 years or something. But it's nice to expand talk more regularly. Is it 4 years, 5 years?
Yeah,
like
4 years. I think it's been 4 years. I mean, it was like 4 years, like in March or something like that. So
it's a bit less gray.
Yeah. So I kind of want to get into Detroit Auto Show a little bit. First of all, just my thoughts on Detroit Auto Show. So I've never been to that show. And just some thoughts, like compared to LA Auto Show, which I've done a bunch of times, you as well. This really just kind of felt like an auto show for the big three. And you didn't get a chance to go, but I don't know how it was last year or in the past, but it was basically like a giant hallway of the big three and the various brands of the big three, right? Jeep and Chrysler and Dodge and Ford and Lincoln. And there was a bit of Volkswagen and a few others. And then in the back corner was like, there was like this barrage of very plain looking, like white signs with black text, no fanfare at all. And it was just all the other automatic. It was like Porsche, Audi, BMW, Jaguar. Like they were all just jammed in there. And it looked like a bunch of cars parked on a carpet, almost like the showroom of a used luxury car dealer. And they were all just kind of jammed in the back. And as you're like opening the door to the Jag to look at the car, you're kind of backing into the Porsche 911, right? It was all kind of just wedged in there. I don't know. Last year, did any of those cars have a presence? Because here in LA, like the Porsche room is like walking through IKEA. There's like footprints on the floor, and it walks you through, and it tells you the story of 911 and Macan and Taycan, and you know, and it's.
I'm sure they'd love you to. I'm sure if you rang Porsche and said, "Hey, it was great. It was just like IKEA," they would love that analogy.
Or like exiting like a Disneyland ride, and they push you out into the store, and it kind of walks you through the store and shows you all the cool things. And you know, and you enter on one side and exit on the other. Like it had a much more of a display, much more fanfare to it. And they got the hospitality area, and this was like two 911s or something like just tucked in the back that you couldn't see. It was just a little sign floating above it.
Well, if you go back a bit, I mean, because a lot of auto shows sort of break into two, the way they're funded breaks into two. So sometimes it's kind of like the manufacturers themselves. So the big shows like LA, Detroit, historically, Geneva, as it used to be, but isn't anymore, was basically the manufacturers themselves paying a shed load of money. I mean, we mean like sometimes tens of millions of dollars. I mean, I think 1 year at Frankfurt, Audi spent 400 million euros. So what's that? That's like 400 million bucks on a insane show stand with a racetrack on board and everything else. And then there's the other side of like the auto shows, which is where dealers basically pay for a bit of carpet. And it feels like Detroit's probably been a combination of two. I mean, like, going back a bit, Detroit used to be pretty much the first week of January.
Yeah.
And it was about minus 100. The wind was howling and everybody used to fly in from all over the world. So those days I was in the UK and it was like the ritual start to the year. You go through the holiday season, you have your New Year party, and then you get on a plane to Detroit and you arrive in like the freezing north. But everybody's there. And this was in the days when Ford owned a bunch of luxury brands like Land Rover, Jaguar.
Yeah.
And everybody else. And people like Mercedes would be in town. It was big. I mean, I remember going to G-Wagon launch, like Arnie turned up. It's that big. And then in recent times, obviously, like the pandemic didn't help. People were starting to drift away from auto shows. Ford jettisoned half its brands. And so it started to be more and more about like just the big three. They fell out of love with auto shows and Detroit kind of panicked a little bit and said, okay, we're not going to do January anymore because also we're competing with a consumer electronics show in Vegas.
Right. Yeah.
So let's do the summer because it's quite nice in Michigan in the summer and everybody will come and we can make it more experiential. And sadly, it just doesn't really feel like it's worked. Last year was the first time they tried it. It was slightly messed up by Biden turning up and kicking all the media out, which was kind of nuts. And then this year I unfortunately was tied up somewhere else. I couldn't make it this year, but you know, we had members of the team there and it feels a little bit like the same thing. And there's like a sniff test to these things. If you walk in and you've got big glamorous stands and you know, the wine flowing on media days and everything else, then it's a show. If it's just a bunch of carpet with some cars parked, then it sort of tends to imply people playing at lip service and they're there because they feel like they need to be.
Yeah. And it's interesting because as the shows like this start to dwindle in attendance and in media coverage, then the car companies all of a sudden have more of a budget to get media out there, right? So now they're reaching out to people that wouldn't normally, you know, be part of the group that gets paid for to get out there. You know, they just cover the trip. They don't pay you to be there. They just like, hey, would you like to go to the Detroit Auto Show? We have an airplane for you, you know, hop on a Delta flight or something and go out there. So it's just kind of interesting. So what you would probably normally see there would be like the big three and all their brands as you walk in to the main hall. And that was there all front and center. And then kind of behind that, you probably would see, like you said, Jaguar, Mercedes and BMW and Alfa Romeo and Land Rover. But instead, they had cars driving. They have, you know, they have Broncos and Jeeps and they're climbing up obstacles and doing these kind of experiential ride-alongs off of, you know, metal and wood that they built together out there. Interesting because they just want to show the vehicle, but it wasn't even like dressed up like here's a fake mountain and you get and there's water flowing out of it. It was just like a metal ramp welded together. And it looked kind of cool to drive on it, but just they filled the space with just experiential driving, like these driving things.
I think this is like how much I think people would be shocked, like how much money goes into auto shows. Like I was being regularly told, like a press conference, like an old school auto show press conference, where you know get this like herd of media turn up, and like from my perspective, it's a bit of a waste of time because everybody gets the same story, and generally what happens is the CEO stands up and spouts a bunch of corporate platitudes, and everybody applauds, and that's the end of it. But these things can cost like $2 million. To put on by the time you've put all the infrastructure together. And that's just the press conference. And then you can spend like $20 million on a stand. And you start to add all this together. And these just things are so expensive to do in the way that they used to do them, which was super glamorous. I mean, I heard one year that a major luxury brand decided that they wanted to bring in their own food because they wanted to create the right ambiance or whatever.
Yeah.
And then the show said, well, no, because we have a contract for food and you have to buy your food from X.
Right. And all the venues have their own food and beverage or caterer company.
Yeah. And they basically, well, we don't want to do that. We want, you know, breakfast and crudités and, you know, whatever. Yeah. So apparently what they did was they bought the food that they had to buy. I believe they took it down to like a local shelter or something, so it wasn't wasted. And they said, all right, now we bought it. Now we can have our own food. And everybody went, all right then.
Yeah, right.
But it was this kind of like grandeur attached to these things.
And they wouldn't be allowed to serve it. You would still have to hire their food and beverage department at the venue to serve it.
Yeah, right? I imagine.
You can't bring in your own workers for it. You have to use their workers.
So there's
especially
a
if you have
like
a bar. If you have a bar with alcohol, you got to use their beverage people. They got to sell to the venue.
Yeah, and you can't get through press day without a
booze. That's for sure.
Without some booze, actually, Morgan at Geneva used to be the best because you had a deal with a couple of whiskey brands, and they always used to have really good single malt. They were really pushing the sort of it's probably not the sort of thing to be admitting, but it was good fun. I mean, back in the day, auto shows were like, I remember starting in this industry, and I started as a 21-year-old in 1998, and I remember my first Geneva show in 1999. And you had this Geneva in Switzerland. The whole idea of like Switzerland was you had this neutral territory, and everybody used to go. And the show was geographically small, which was a good thing because it meant that everybody basically had a similar size stand, and it was a super glamorous location. Everybody loved going, and this was always at the beginning of March. And a lot of people would go over. You'd ski in the Alps. You'd go to the show. It was great, and Fiat used to do a boat, and then Volkswagen took it over, where they literally moored a boat on Lake Geneva and just had like a free bar all night. So you went to the show, then you went to the famous boat and pretty much drank themselves into a stupor till 6 o'clock in the morning, stumbled off the boat, went home. I mean, this is pre social media and pre internet, everything else, but it was like, I don't know. I look back on those times, and in some ways they were great, but they just feel so far removed from where we are today.
You could do all that if there's not a driving event, right?
There was a famous game, like some Volkswagen group, like board member turned up at 2 o'clock in the morning, and there's like media like stumbling around. Everybody's completely hammered on free Verve Click A or whatever it was. And apparently, and he looked around and expressed concern that the place was too busy and just looked out of control. And he said something like, next year, we need another boat. But these were great days. Were they great days? I suppose they were great days if you were like 21 and somebody was offering you a free bar for. Yeah.
Yeah. And the whole experience and bring you around and make sure you're getting a ride or you're walking to your hotel or back and forth. Like it's all kind of very planned. I will say that like that aspect of what we get to see a little bit with working with the manufacturers and going, hey, you're going to come out to this event or you come out to this event. It's usually pretty well done. Like how they handle hospitality and accommodations and travel and just moving you to point A to point B. You know, I was just out there. I was out there pretty much with Ford. I was out there for a few days because they wanted to have me there for the launch of the F-150. And then like 2 days later or three days later, basically I was there Monday morning for F-150 event. And then the auto show doesn't open until Wednesday. And then Wednesday night, they were doing this big Mustang event where they had everything Mustang related, by the way. It was very cool. Motorsports, whatever. They had Bob Tasca's funny car to the new GT3, GT4. They had the Mustangs and Dark Horse and GTD and all kind of under one roof in one area. And, the stock car there. So they're like, this is Mustang and motorsports. So I did as much work as I could from the hotel and recorded a podcast, did whatever, but I had a little bit of time. So I said, hey, where's the Ford headquarters in relation to the hotel? I want to take a tour of the plant. And they're like, oh, well, yeah, we didn't think about that. That's a great idea. And I was like, yeah, I want to go to the Rouge plant where they build the F-150. And I know we got into this a little bit earlier in the week with Goldberg, but they said, great. They got a ticket. They fired up a transit van and someone drove me over there. And I went on the tour basically by myself. And I walked out and the guy was waiting for me. He's like, hope you enjoyed your tour. Let's go back to the hotel. And it was a nice half a day to tour all that. I got more into what the tour was, and just super impressive, by the way. Just
it's funny, if you've never been to a car plant, they're like extraordinary things.
I mean,
just as a thing to behold, and how fast you make cars and the complexity of the robots, and they're amazing.
That assembly line moves at a pace that each worker gets 53 seconds to accomplish what they have to do, put in a headliner or put a door glass in or whatever. But it doesn't stop unless the whole thing stops, which means every 53 seconds, it's spitting off a fully completed F-150 at the end of the assembly line. It's cool. It's impressive for sure. And then they were saying they were building a new plant in Kentucky that's like two times the size, maybe more than that. They're like, wait till that's done, come see that. And I was like, I would love to go see that. It's massive.
I also have like big respect for a lot of people who work on those lines, because you know, I have the attention span of a gnat, and you know, it's repetitive. There's no getting away from it. It's repetitive work, and to have that kind of level of, you know, attention, and to do that, I remember doing a shoot in Saarlouis in France with Ford has a plant down there. They used to make the Focus. I think they still may do. And there was a guy there, and he was like the front right door guy. Mm-hmm. And basically what they tend to do, I believe, not, I don't know whether every company does this, but they kind of rotate people around the line so that you don't get bored. But
yeah,
this guy just wanted to do doors. So he'd done for like 16 years. He'd been like putting a front right door on a Focus.
Yeah.
And I just had huge respect for that, because I couldn't do that. My mind would disappear after a few minutes, and then I wouldn't necessarily be paying attention, or my 53 seconds would be up or whatever it would be. And yeah, it's quite a thing to work in one of those places. And it gives you a real appreciation of what goes into a car when you kind of see it come together.
Yes, it certainly does. And the combination of the people, and there are some robots putting the, you know, front and rear glass in on an F-150, and all of its lasers it uses for alignment, and just kind of how it all works. But not everybody has to work exactly the same. I saw a couple of guys working in the cab of the truck. The carpet was in, dash was in, but the rear seats and stuff weren't in, and they were doing some of the trim on the rear bulkhead below the rear glass. And one guy looked like he liked to climb into the vehicle and do his thing. And another guy was on a seat on a giant swing arm, and the swing arm would like move him into the vehicle. So he wanted to sit and do it, and somebody else didn't want to sit and do it, but they were essentially doing the same thing. And it looked like two stations. And as it moves along, you almost like skip every other one, because you know they're moving at a quick pace, but you like you said, it's very repetitious. And I saw somebody working on a door, and this woman was putting the mirror on and putting the screws in and locking them down and doing a few things, and then the next door would kind of go by and she wouldn't touch it, but then the next person would. So there's multiple people doing the same thing. It's not like one person is doing every single side mirror. But yeah, it was interesting to see. And you're right, once it's in, you get a rhythm to it. It looked like everyone was like comfortable in what they were doing, probably because they keep doing it and doing it. But
it also gives you a reason of like how the whole just-in-time supply, where everything arrives at the plant just in time to be fitted, so you don't stockpile everything. It gives you an understanding of like when, you know, we've had all the supply problems in the past couple of years, how that breaks down. That, you know, if the grommets don't arrive, you know, if like a little rubber bushing for some suspension part doesn't arrive, then like the whole thing's screwed.
Yeah,
and it's just an extraordinary like logistical challenge to put these things together.
That was an interesting thing, because so many fasteners are being installed, and if one fastener goes in and the threads cross, or the threads on that screw were not correct, the entire assembly line has to stop.
Yeah.
Until that is fixed, right? And now they didn't say this to me, but I started looking at it and I was like, there's so many parts that have the stud portion attached to it. So people just attach a bolt. They don't thread into metal. And I think it's probably has a lot to do with that. Has a lot to do with two parts is when you put a part on and it's got studs on it, it kind of holds itself in place. And I saw a lot of workers doing that, putting a mirror on. It holds itself under the door because it's on studs. And then she goes, gets the bolts and puts the bolts on the end of those studs. If you put a screw into the mirror, you'd have to hold the mirror on one side, put the screw into the other, right? And there was a lot of studs involved for that reason, I would imagine, and probably to help prevent like cross-threading into a piece like a nutsert in a door, right? So instead, everything's kind of done the opposite way. Anyway, kind of interesting. I was fascinated by the whole process. And there's a whole much more to the whole building and everything that you can hear about on the other show.
Yeah. And then when you look at like EV plants now, like trying to put in all the batteries and then having to re-engineer everything for that, it's crazy stuff.
It's crazy, yeah. Which kind of brings up the UAW strike, which as we're here recording this, it just started. It just happened. And a little different than what's happened in the past is it seemed like in the past, if the UAW was going to strike to try to get some leverage in their negotiating, and I'm not saying I have the slightest idea what's happening behind the scenes, so I don't want to speak to that. But instead, they said, no, we're going to go to the big three companies all at once instead of having one manufacturer like Ford or GM doing the negotiating, and then they would strike maybe one plant for that manufacturer. But instead, they're striking at three plants, one of each of the big three, and shutting down 12,700 employees, shutting down of the, I don't know, what is it, 100,000 plus, maybe way more than that.
It's a little bit more than that, but it feels, I mean, I'm not sort of close to this, the side of things, but it's interesting how they're going about it, because obviously it's not everybody out, and they're also at the moment not targeting the big cash cow vehicles like the F-150, the Silverado, etc.
Yeah.
So
yeah.
It's kind of pretty strategic at the moment, shall we say? So I think, you know, the what's affected is Colorado, Bronco, Ranger, Wrangler, etc. So, and the other thing at the moment, I think it's about 9% of the membership is currently effectively not working. I was surprised that this is the first time it's actually affected all of the big three simultaneously.
Yeah.
It's a serious situation that could escalate.
It is. Now, you know, they're asking for more money and fewer hours and some more benefits, which I think is on par with what a union would do. I don't know the financials behind the whole thing of what's reasonable, what's not reasonable. All we can do is kind of look at the history and what does that mean for consumers, right? It means that at some point, whatever inventory is left on dealer lots or, you know, still being shipped or in a, you know, a parking lot at the factory, that's going to get used up. And then when that's used up, you won't be able to get for a while, as you said, Ranger, Jeep Gladiator, Bronco, you know, GMC Savannah, like, you know, Chevy Colorado. And that does start to trickle down to the consumer as well. Those vehicles that you want that you can't get will go up in price. Anything used will go up in price. You know, who knows? You know, we saw a lot of dealer markups from dealers when supply chain was significantly limited, because the dealers needed to make money, basically. And so now you're getting markups on things you would never expect a markup on. You know, it's not, you know, some crazy limited production supercar. It's a, I don't know, it's a Kia Telluride. Like, why? They want to make as many as possible. Why? why would you pay $10,000 over sticker when you will lose it immediately? But anyway, that's kind of the trickle down effect of what's happening over there. So hopefully it gets worked out.
Yeah,
doesn't sound
so.
Like they're close.
It's an interesting, because at the moment there is the models in question have, from what I understand, have decent inventory. So basically, dealers have stock to sell. But eventually, that would, in theory, run out. There's also the risk that the strike extends to other workers, other lines. And of course, at the moment, this is only affecting the big three. So, what will consumers do? Well, consumers potentially, if they can't get supply of the big three, will start to look around the market and say, well, what can I get?
Yeah.
Can I get a Toyota? Can I get a Honda? And right. Then you're into market share and everything else. And, if you look back at the history of the British car industry, for example, back in the 1970s, there was an awful lot of strikes. Some of that was management related. Some of that was union related. And the industry never really recovered. And so it's always a worrying time. And, the history of the car is littered with these sort of problems and, brands being compromised as a result and never quite recovering. So we will see. It's a long way from that at the moment, and I suspect it'll get sorted out sooner rather than later.
Hopefully it does. If this goes for more than like 30 days, there's going to be a boom in Honda Ridgeline sales, which I'm sure Honda would really appreciate.
yeah, and and the old argument used to be the loyalty thing, but actually obviously a lot of these most of these vehicles are made in the US in different plants anyway. The BMWs, the charges, etc. So we will see, but yeah, it's the knock-on effect down the line to and these sort of things can play out 2 or 3 years later with used car supply and everything else that goes with it. It's also a kind of point in the where the industry is actually with the whole move to electrification, the industry is in a tight spot generally. And although we've seen profits looking pretty good, the amount of money that's then been reinvested into research and development to try and break through in the EV market is huge.
Yeah.
And that's putting massive pressure because at the moment, EVs are not very profitable, certainly if you're not Tesla. And Ford's been struggling to make money on the Mach-E, struggling to make money on the Lightning. And there's a price war going on in that market. So it's just another pressure. And it's it's going to be a kind of tough few years of transition for a lot of manufacturers as we move to this kind of EV future. So if you kind of layer on this on top, then it's a tough place to be.
Moving on to the auto show.
Happier news.
Yeah, right.
Cars you can buy.
I know you weren't there, but I know your team brought back some information. And again, because the show is mostly about the big three, and we covered it earlier this week on the shows, is a lot around the Ford F-150, kind of a mid-cycle refresh of F-150, some new features, some new trim updates, heads-up display, their new fancy tailgate, some pretty cool. I mean, the cool features are the modular front bumper on some of the models like Tremor are very cool. The tailgate option is cool. That's a kind of a welcome new feature. Heads up display, and they're all going to get digital dash. Some of the lower end models were not getting a digital dash. Now they're all going to get digital dash. The app, which has the Ford app, which has a feature that kind of gets a little closer to Tesla, a little closer to managing your own anti-theft features, would be if anything's happening to your truck, it has an accelerometer in the truck. So if somebody even jacks up your truck to steal the wheels on it or tries to tow it or steal it, it would alert you on your app. Now, if it's 3 a.m. and you're asleep and you're not going to see it, then you're going to see it when you get up. But if you're up and you see it immediately, it will give you the option to go, hey, this is me, don't worry about it. Or it'll say, this is not me, I'd like to contact the authorities. And it helps you do that process. You can contact the authorities. It fills in some of the information, sends VIN number. It's kind of a cool feature. Or if you're like Goldberg, you can take matters into your own hand, although not recommended.
Send the zebra.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
it happened to us in the Lucid the other week. We have a Lucid that we own as part of our fleet. And I suddenly got a you know, one of those Apple notifications saying you're lucid is, I can't remember the phraseology, it basically said like you're lucid is a weird angle and an angle not commensurate with typical driving.
Yeah.
And then I looked, we have like a sheet that you can go to and see who's got it. And it said, nobody's got it. And I was like, oh, gosh, this is like, rang around the office. Like, what's happened? It's getting towed. It's got it. Somebody's pinched it. Turned out to be a false alarm. But I mean, this stuff's, even we have my family car is a Genesis. And that has a feature where you can push a button on the app and it will take pictures around the car to show you what's going on around the vehicle. So yeah, there's some really cool tech sort of moving over from consumer electronics and things like that, and everybody's getting into it. I mean, the F-150 thing was, it seemed to me like I haven't sort of physically seen it yet, but it seems like a classic case of, if it isn't bust, don't fix it, isn't it? If it ain't bust, don't fix it.
Right.
Like,
so that,
a few tweaks here and there. Don't spend too much money. Tidy up the software.
And you know, you're right. So a lot more tech forward stuff, right? Because those are things that they can change a little bit more on the fly without a real hardware investment. And you're right. Those types of things don't affect the assembly line that we were just talking about, right? Putting the digital dash in all of the F-150s is no different than the assembly line currently, because it already has it on some of the vehicles. So they're just saying, now we're out with the analog. Now we're just, everything's going to be that option.
And the fact that you're then building everything with it probably means that the cost comes down, everything else. And yeah, it's interesting. Well, like, as an aside, I got a notification. I'm living with the Rivian R1T at the moment, the truck. And we've been critical of the ride quality, and the ride quality is not great. And then suddenly there's an over-air update, which is promising to improve the ride quality. So it's like, it's going to take 65 minutes, but you'll feel a better ride quality. And
did you try it?
Yeah, and it genuinely has given you a little bit more compliance. And I mean, it's not like you've suddenly stepped out of a truck into a Mercedes S-Class, but it is, you know, if you're used to jumping out and out of different cars, then, you know, it does feel a bit different, and it has improved it. But it's, I mean, yeah, that's a function of the fact that the Rivian's got air suspension, electronic damping, so you can do stuff with software. You know, if everything's passive on your car, you can't do that. But it is crazy. Like, we think about, you know, just what you can do now. Somebody at Rivian can say, like, oh, we sorted the damping, we tweaked the suspension, like, this is not hardware, we're going to push a button and suddenly everybody in a Rivian has got a better ride quality.
Yes, and that is kind of cool, and that is kind of a trick feature to it. I mean, look, Ford also talked about the Mustang Mach-E, the Rally-E.
I think that's cool, right?
And I think it's
a bit
cool
of a gimmick, but I think it's cool.
You know, when you see, like, oh, Porsche's got Porsche Dakar and Lamborghini's whatever off-road type vehicle,
what's it called, Huracan? I know which one you mean.
I don't know. And I saw one in Monterey, and you know, like, I walked by and I was like, oh, this is kind of cool, but I don't know who gets it. But we were at the track at Laguna Seca, and I'm sure whoever brought that thing had a VIP parking spot, but they're like, no, I'm going to hit the dirt lot. I'm going to park with everybody else because it's the only time that everything, that thing's going to see dirt is when you're in the dirt lot at Laguna Seca. But the Mach-E is, you know, it sits almost an inch higher. It's like 22 millimeters higher. It's got a cool, like, I don't know, like rotiform kind of wheel or something on it. And, the tires to equip it. But talking about just software improvements, they're saying that thing is quicker 0 to 60 than the Mach-E performance, the Mach-E GT performance, which is 0 to 60 in like 3.5. This will do it a little faster. I don't know, maybe it's 3.4, but the point is they were able to just do it with software. And then you had mentioned a while back, the amount of time you get that peak power is really kind of limited on that Mach-E, and it's supposed to be longer, be available longer in the Rally-E. And when I asked them about it, and they said, really, it was just efficiency in software. It was just, we're able to just do it all on a computer.
Yeah. You know, and have some fun with it at the same time. Do you know how much that thing's going to cost you? I haven't seen the price for it.
I don't know.
It's going to be a chunk of change.
I had it somewhere, but I don't know what it is. But look, I don't know what it's a Mach-E performance, GT performance, 60, 65 grand. I think it's going to be somewhere in there. I don't think it's like a $15,000 markup. It's a couple of grand.
I think, I say markup,
but I don't mean like a jump. I don't think it's going to be $80,000. I think it's going to be.
Yeah. I'm just looking at our content on it. It's about 65 grand, which I think it's going to be a bit of fun at that price. None of these things are cheap.
I saw it in person and, you know, it's got revised front end. It's got the wing on the back and it's got the cool stance to it. And kind of this, it's a 911 Dakar for, you know, less than a third of the
price.
Almost
911 money. Well, not quite. Yeah. You
know, the 911 Dakar just sold on Ring of Trailer for like $325,000 or something, or $340,000 or something ridiculous like that. And when it was stickered, it was, I don't know, it was 250 or 280 or something. It was a wildly big jump from 911 to 911 Dakar. And I'm not saying this is apples to apples by any means. That's a cool car, but the Mustang Rally E is not slow, right? Like it's fast. If it's anywhere near that 3.5 second range, I think it's going to scoot around pretty good.
Yeah. And the Mach-E generally is quite fun to drive. And if you stick some chunky seats in it and tighten it up a little bit, it's only going to get better. And yeah, it's nice that they're having fun with it. I mean, you know, I grew up, you know, my kind of love for cars, if you like, came from that era of the Sierra RS500, the Cosworths, which never really kind of had the same, you know, that was more of a kind of European thing, but like the Escort RS Cosworth that they all went rallying with. And they were iconic cars, and, you know, they had the big wings and the crazy turbos. And it's kind of fun that they're starting to bring that into the EV world. And I think that's something that we're going to now see in the next year or two, is that everybody's going to try and reimagine their icons as EVs. So we've seen Volkswagen come out and show off like a GTI EV. BMW is going to talk about like a proper sort of M3 equivalent, but electric, or an M5, which is genuinely electric. And everybody's got these really, really powerful brands. So everybody's saying, well, we can't just give up on 50 years of heritage. So how do we take this forward in electric world? So I think we're going to see more and more of this stuff. I mean, the Volkswagen was really interesting as a front-wheel drive hot hatch EV. So yeah, we'll see. It's cool.
Now, there was more out there. What did you guys bring home? Any news on anything interesting?
The Gladiator, you know, Jeep's little pickup truck, that's had a refresh. The Wrangler is basically just bringing it in line with the Wrangler, because that truck shares so much with the Wrangler.
Yeah.
That it's just bringing it, you know, new infotainment, that sort of thing. It's bringing it up to speed. I mean, the Gladiator has always been a strange one in that, you know, it's never quite captured the imagination. I want to say it sells about half as many as a Tacoma, if that, barely that, I think. So, and the Tacoma's had some supply problems as well. So it's, you know, it's a nice thing. It's an interesting vehicle, but it's just never quite captured the imagination, I think, as perhaps Jeep hoped it would.
You know, I walk through Buick, and they've got a couple of sharp looking vehicles. What's going on with Buick? We never talk about it. Nobody ever talks about Buick. I mean,
well, a lot of their vehicles for a long time were basically rebadged GMs from Europe, and of course then Opel got sold and everything else, that created thing. No, it's right. It's like the forgotten American brand, isn't it? We don't come on the show and talk about it. You know, years ago they had Tiger Woods, but then, you know, that's not happening anymore. So, you know, they just seem to sort of plod along doing their thing and appealing to a, you know, certain demographic. And yeah, it's just, but
they don't seem to like come up in rankings of vehicle tests when we look at like what are the hot SUVs. And And I mean, Buick comes up when somebody says, where can I get a pretty good deal on a new car? And go, yeah, Buick's got some pretty good deals on cars. And that's the only time anybody ever asks me about Buick. But I don't really see it like rank anywhere. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with it. I'm just saying they're getting by with just being okay. And attracting a customer that is like, this seems nice enough.
There's a few brands. I mean, Infiniti probably falls into that category as well. I mean, Acura at times. I think Acura's products improved recently, but it's more, you know, where they sort of sit in this middle world where they're not quite mainstream, they're not quite luxury. You know, they don't have a cachet, and then you know you end up competing on the deal and the proposition more than the kind of, you know, I must have one of those, but. You know, you can do okay in that world. So, you know,
Acura stands out a little bit more because they're pretty active in motorsports, right?
And I think Acura's got some interesting stuff.
Yeah, they got some cool things going on, and not that we saw it at this auto show, but so I did see Cadillac Lyric, I didn't see Acura ZDX, but this is essentially a shared platform now. Cadillac released their vehicle first. So Acura had a little bit more time to figure out what they're going to do with this very, very basic platform, right? And their answer was a little more room on the inside, certainly a little bit different look than the Cadillac. And now it's going to be essentially going to be who executed better on that platform, Cadillac versus Acura, because I don't know that one of those brands stands out more than the other. I guess maybe Cadillac does a little bit because Cadillac's hit. Cadillac has gotten a lot of attention from some of its V series vehicles, its performance vehicles, right? The CT5 Blackwing, cool, a little long in the tooth, a little dated. There was a little refresh cosmetically on it at the Detroit Auto Show, but yes, it's still cool because you can go, hey, I can jump in an incredibly fast, awesome four-door with a manual transmission, and there's not many options like that available. So that is cool. Or a Cadillac says, I'm going to do a giant Escalade, put a ridiculous engine in it, make it a V-Series, and it's gonna sound like a Camaro.
And I think all these brands, like, they have to work out in this new world what they are. And yeah. I think this has been particularly true of Cadillac for a while. It's like, are you the American luxury brand, or are you trying to be like an American sports brand, or are you trying to be, you know, and the same with Acura. Is it just like a posh Honda? Is it trying to be a sports car? Is it trying to be, and especially then you go into the EV world.
Yeah.
And I think Cadillac, you know, from what we're seeing, there's some, you know, they're trying to reposition themselves as this, you know, America does luxury, and maybe that's a good place for them to be. And yeah, we'll see.
Well, Lincoln is there as well. Lyric,
you can't buy one.
Right. Lincoln is there as well, but Lincoln needs to build a better car. There's no secret around that. Ford knows it. Everybody knows it. Like they did some really great redesigns, and you know, Aviator and stuff is nice looking, nice on the inside, but the quality is just not there. That's been an issue, whether it's a Ford issue, a supplier issue, but ultimately it falls on their shoulders and they just need to build a better vehicle. But I think Lincoln has a better shot of being the luxury brand than Cadillac, because Cadillac has been leaning, all of its press is around the performance side of it. So, and I don't know what that means. What does that compete with? BMW-ish? You know?
Yeah, Audi, BMW, yeah. Mercedes, I guess. You could say Acura, but that they would say that they're above Acura in the, you know, in the brand perception. Going back to Lincoln, it's kind of pointed at this week, it's a bit inside baseball this, but Ford just hired a CMO from Toyota, and it was really pointed in the press release that she talked about Lincoln specifically. And I think, you know, there was always this feeling that, you know, when they bought Jaguar, they bought Land Rover, they had Aston Martin for a while, and they were going to really focus on this kind of European luxury. Ford no longer has that. So that, you know, Lincoln is their last hope of doing something with, you know, let's face it, with margin. And, you know, we're seeing a lot of these mainstream brands, Seat's just gone to the wall in they're shutting down that in Europe because they want to focus on Cupra, which is more of an upmarket brand. So ultimately that's where the margin is, you know, the margin's in Audi, not Volkswagen.
Yeah.
So if you can make these luxury brands work, then, you know, there's a lot of money to be made.
Well, I would say that these car companies have a lot of work ahead of them. just so many things outside of their world, you know, like UAW now and politics and
charging infrastructure,
charging infrastructure. And like, there's so many things that are, I don't want to say outside of their world. It's definitely affecting them. There's a grasp on it, but I don't know, just a lot that you probably would have said to them 10 years ago, get ready for charging infrastructure, get ready for supply chain issues, get ready for, you know, battery technology in China, and get ready for all that. They'd be like, what are you talking about?
Yeah. And who, what was the one company that figured all this out? Tesla.
Yeah.
I just started reading Elon Musk's new autobiography. That's not autobiography, biography. That's kind of an interesting read.
I heard he's not happy about it, but
no, but the book is kind of saying that's what makes him happy. So we'll see. Maybe there's a double negative in there somewhere.
One last thing is, as we wrap it up, I know you guys are working on more videos. The U-Drag stuff is always kind of fun. What's the latest version you guys got?
Well, we have a Civic Type R against the Corolla. Corolla, so we got front-wheel drive against all-wheel drive. So that's been getting some chat with a kind of surprising result. Well, sort of surprising.
Who's driving? Are you driving in this one?
I'm driving in that one.
What car are you driving?
Well, we drive both. So you start in one and then swap to the other. So
I'll watch the video to get the results. But which one do you like to drive better?
What I said when you say this in the video is I don't want to run a spoiler, but the Toyota's cool. If you had like in the canyons or something like that, or on dirt, the Toyota would be more fun just because it's a bit more raw and urgent and more like a kind of rally car. But the Civic's just a really good polished thing. I mean, I never imagined that you'd say I'd prefer a front wheel drive car to an all wheel drive or something, but the Civic's just a really well done thing.
And I've driven the Civic and it is cool. I'm not really a front wheel drive fan, but for what it is, I think that's a very, very cool car. But I still haven't driven the Acura Integra, the Type S, the Civic version.
Yeah, it's basically the same car, but a little bit more refined. So it's a little bit like...
But it's an all-wheel drive version.
No, it's still front-wheel drive.
Is it?
Are you getting your Acura confused here? I'm about to embarrass myself. No, it's the same. What they have got, they haven't got like there's a bit less... It's a sort of more mature version of the Civic Type R. Are you googling this?
I'm just curious. I thought
we're gonna have to edit this out, or my reputation is gonna be in tatters.
I just thought they were doing their super handling all wheel drive, but I guess it's probably just front wheel drive. You're probably right. It's probably no real difference. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe they don't offer it. I don't know if they offer the. I don't think they're gonna have an all wheel drive version of the Integra.
I don't think the platform would take it, but it's a cool car. And the Integra is just a slightly more grown-up version. So if you feel slightly self-conscious in a Civic Type R, which I can understand why you'd feel that, then maybe the Integra is a good look.
Right on. All right. So Edmunds.com is the website. You can find everything there and subscribe to their YouTube channel as well, so you can see what's going on with Alistair on video. If listening to him is not enough, you want to see him as well. You can tune in there.
He's struggling with insomnia. I'm better than melatonin.
All right, I think that's going to wrap it up for us this week. Thanks,
good point,
guys.
To end on.
Until next week, keep the air and the spare and the bag and the wheel.
For the latest updates and call-in times, follow the show on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at CarCast Show. If you'd like to write in, fill out the form on CarCastShow.com. And don't forget to give us a nice rating on iTunes. CarCast is a Corolla Digital production and is produced by Chris Loxamana. For more information, visit CarCastShow.com.
For the ones who know safety isn't a catchphrase, it's a culture. And the ones who help make sure everyone makes it home safe. For the safety-minded who watch everyone's backs, Grainger offers supplies and solutions for every industry, as well as safety assessments and training to keep your facilities safe and your people safer. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.